Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Brian Schaffner. He's a political scientist at UMass Amherst. And he has done a study that provides some empirical support for the so-called Trump effect. Yes, Trump's rhetoric appears to be making white people more hateful. And then we'll be joined by Heather Digby Parton, always a favorite on this show. And she and I will chat about the conservative victimhood complex. Very well-developed victimhood complex. But first, you may have missed a kind of unusual kerfuffle on Capitol Hill this week. House Speaker Paul Ryan fired the House chaplain. I don't know why there's a House chaplain, but okay. The guy's named Patrick Conroy. He's a Catholic priest. He served as the House chaplain since 2011. And his crime, apparently, was committed while they were debating the GOP's tax scam. Conroy, he prayed for Congress to, and let me quote this, to, quote, guarantee that there are not winners and losers under the new tax cut laws, under the new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans. Amen. Ryan, who is himself a Roman Catholic, apparently saw this as a grave sin against the holy text of Ayn Rand. So he was crafting this bill that gives, you know, massive windfalls to the folks at the top, will create a tax increase for many people in the middle class when the terms expire in 10 years. And this was a bridge too far. So he fires this guy kind of quietly. Then the guy goes to the New York Times and says, hey, this guy fired me for this prayer in which I made this comment on policy, basically. Story took a turn then when Representative Mark Walker from North Carolina, this is an evangelical Christian, and he's the guy leading the search for a replacement, and he told reporters that he thought that the next chaplain should be a family man. Now, this, of course, eliminates the possibility that, you know, another Catholic could take the gig, another one of those, you know, dirty papists. And some Catholic Democrats freaked out. They accused the House GOP caucus of basically being in the thrall to evangelical Christians and plagued with anti-Catholic sentiment. So you have this little thing brewing, and it all is happening as Donald Trump, this pervy, foul-mouthed guy who made millions on gambling and who has five kids by three different women and, you know, bangs porn stars on the side, continues to enjoy, like, unprecedented support among devout evangelical Christians. They're just sticking with him. And there have been lots of people who are like, why is this happening? What is wrong with these people? Gillian Tett wrote at the Financial Times this week that there are a couple of theories. There's some people say, well, there's this prodigal son phenomenon. So they know that he's ungodly, but their whole shtick is we're all sinners, and they're hoping that he may yet repent. Another is that they're basically courting Trump because they are losing political clout, and they think that he will make Christianity great again. And then there's this other theory proposed by sociologist Francesca Tripodi that evangelicals use this, have an abiding distrust for the mainstream media. And they're also taught to do deep reading of biblical texts and not pay attention to human interpretations of those texts. So basically she found these like Bible groups that were applying those same techniques to the Trump tax bill. They were reading the Trump tax bill and taking from it, I guess, what they want. But there was a paper published in January in the journal Sociology of Religion, and it was actually titled Make Christianity Great Again, Christian Nationalism and Voting for Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. And they argued that it's all about Christian nationalism. And this is this ideology that it fuses kind of like love of God and jingoism. And it hinges on the idea that the U.S. has a special covenant with with their God, their idea of God. And this ideology has emerged at various times in U.S. history, but there's like this aggressive iteration now, according to a report in Think Progress. And it kind of rejects secular society, and it looks to restore America as a Christian nation. And the researchers found that Americans who believed in the tenets of Christian nationalism had a very strong likelihood of voting Trump. And this was true, according to the Huffington Post, even when the research team controlled for other influences like political ideology and party affiliation. The findings suggest that Christian nationalism is a unique and independent influence that led to the Trump presidency. Now, it should go without saying that in the Christian nationalist view, America has no room for, you know, dirty atheists and Jews and Muslims and people of other faiths, and certainly no room for the LGBT community. So that's what we're dealing with. And it seems like evangelicals' belief that Trump will restore, well, the kinds of values that he's never adhered to in his life is why they're sticking with him until the rapture takes them away or he's impeached, whichever comes first. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and come back with Brian Schaffner.
Feeling like a frost and staring at the stars. It doesn't matter the cost, 'cause everybody wants to be famous. I'm calling the shots, so see you over a bar. It doesn't matter the cost, seems like everybody wants to be. I think it could be.
I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, we've heard a lot about the Trump effect since he came down that gilded escalator and claimed that Mexico was sending us all their rapists. There's been that spike in hate crimes. It's been pretty well documented. We've seen white supremacists and neo-Nazis emboldened. They're marching through the streets with their tiki torches. There are lots of anecdotes about children of color or foreign-born children being bullied by their white classmates in school. My next guest has looked at this Trump effect empirically. So, you know, we can all speculate about it, but now there's some evidence that it is a real thing. Brian Schaffner is a political scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's the author of a really interesting study. It's titled Follow the Racist: The Consequences of Expressions of Elite Prejudice for Mass Rhetoric. Brian Schaffner, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Before we get into your experiment, I just want to touch briefly on the context in terms of the previous academic studies. You write, and I quote, "The research on racial rhetoric in American politics has long held that a norm of racial equality leads Americans to reject elite rhetoric that is explicitly racist." But you also note that other recent scholarship has found that those norms have kind of become frayed in recent years. Can you tell us a little bit about the literature on this topic?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. There's a few famous books published maybe 20 years ago now that had basically shown that when candidates used language during a campaign or during a debate that was explicitly racist, that voters would basically indicate that they liked that candidate less and that they'd be less willing to vote for them. So the idea was basically that that politicians had to, if they wanted to sort of make racial appeals, they had to do it in a very subtle, sort of implicit way. More recently, Nick Valentino at University of Michigan and some of his colleagues did several experiments which basically showed that those penalties no longer were showing up in the experiments that they were doing, that when candidates said sort of explicitly racist things, that actually voters weren't penalizing them for that. So those studies were interestingly done before Trump.
Okay.
So this was something that they were doing actually before Trump entered the 2016 presidential race. So it was almost sort of like a canary in the coal mine for what happened after that.
Were those studies post Obama?
They were mostly done during Obama's second term. And you know, it's hard to know exactly why this norm has gone away in recent years, but their speculation, and I think it's a reasonable speculation, is that it's basically a reaction to the Obama presidency, that that sort of white resentment spiked during sort of the Obama presidency, and that it was almost sort of like permission was given to now sort of be more explicitly racist in a way that in the past people hadn't felt comfortable doing.
We had John Sides on the show a while back. He was talking about a study he did, and he said that, you know, the white working class voters that have been the subject of so much discussion had moved towards the Republicans before Trump announced his campaign as a backlash to Obama. And I think that that's it's consistent with what you're saying right now. Let's talk about the experiment you conducted for the study. What was the question you were trying to get at?
Well, you know, I became really interested in this idea of a Trump effect during the campaign, and the notion that basically the fact that Donald Trump was willing to say explicitly sort of racist or xenophobic things on the campaign trail was emboldening, you know, regular citizens to do the same in their everyday lives. And, you know, while we have a lot of sort of anecdotal and observational evidence that this is the case, what we don't know is whether what Trump is doing is actually causing this. In other words, if these expressions are actually being caused by the way that Trump is speaking. So my motivation was basically to test whether this is really a causal effect or whether it's something that's sort of happening simultaneously, or even if, you know, people were already talking this way and Trump was just sort of taking advantage of it. So I wanted to basically be able to unpack whether Trump himself was causing this.
And tell us about the experiment you designed.
Yeah, so basically what I did was we ran the experiment in October during the campaign, so October of 2016, so near Election Day. And what I did was I wanted to expose people to some of the explicitly sort of racist things that Trump had said, but I wanted to do it without sort of indicating to them what I was trying to get at. So what I did was I asked people, you know, here are some things that candidates said during the campaign. Can you identify, you know, which candidate said this thing? It was, you know, so basically as it seemed to respondents, like I was just sort of interested in how much attention they'd been paying to the campaign. And what I did was I randomly inserted for some respondents, Trump's quote about Mexicans, and then another Trump quote about African-Americans. So some people saw that quote and some people didn't. And then after that question, I basically just asked people sort of in your own words, what do you think of the following groups? And I asked about the groups that Trump had targeted, but then I also asked about sort of unrelated groups like millennials and politicians and people like that. So again, it was the idea was to disguise as much as possible the fact that I was sort of interested in seeing whether if you saw the Trump quote, you would say something more explicitly racist. But that was basically what I was doing is I wanted to then see what did people write about these groups when they saw the Trump quote compared to when they did not.
Listeners should understand that there's an issue in studies like this one. It's called the demand effect. And to put it very simply, it means that the person administering a survey or conducting some other kind of experiment gives respondents cues about what constitutes appropriate behavior. And they then are more likely to offer what they see as the so-called right answer. So you were very cautious to kind of hide, you know, what you were getting at or the key issues here. So what were your findings?
Yeah, so basically the finding was that I had basically randomized in two Trump quotes, and one of them was about African-American protesters in Baltimore being thugs, and the other one was the famous quote about Mexicans being rapists and whatnot. And that the quote about Mexicans had a pretty strong effect actually on the types of things that people said about Mexicans. But interestingly, it also had a pretty strong effect on what they said about other groups. So people who heard Trump's language about Mexicans from his speech entering the campaign were more likely to write things about Mexicans that were offensive and very negative, but they were also more likely to say things that were offensive about African Americans, and they were even more likely to say things that were offensive about millennials. So one of the main findings here that I think was really interesting was that Trump's language doesn't just embolden people to say more negative and more offensive things about the group he's talking about, but it actually emboldens them to say more offensive things about all groups.
That is so fascinating. So the cue, it's not just that they think, oh, he's right, Mexicans are bad people, they're sending rapists. They also have a more negative view towards other minority groups. So we should point out this is only non-Hispanic whites. All the subjects were non-Hispanic whites. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
So it may seem intuitive how this is working. You know, you see somebody who's vying for the highest office in the land talking about this stuff, and it maybe gives you a leave to do so. But just talk for a moment about the mechanisms that you think might be at work here. I mean, how is it that people become more bigoted by hearing bigoted rhetoric from a politician?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there's a few possibilities here. And I tried to eliminate some of them. So one, you know, like one possibility would be that people just heard these words that Trump used. And so they just reuse the same words because they're sort of fresh in their minds when they are asked to talk about other groups. I was actually able to test for that, and not much of that is going on. So people aren't just mimicking Trump's language. What I think is going on is that people aren't always sure sort of what the norms are about, you know, what's okay to say and what's not okay to say. And so there's several studies in psychology research showing that people sort of take cues from their peers when they're basically asked to talk about other groups, and that when they hear somebody saying something more offensive about a group, that they're more likely to say something offensive because they think basically what they're getting from that is like, oh, that's okay to say, like that other person said it, so it must be okay to say something like that. And I think something similar is going on here, that people hear sort of a politician who is, you know, running for president, who is using this terminology, and they think, well, if a major party president presidential candidate is using this language, then it must be okay to use this language. And so what I think is going on is people are basically changing their understandings of what the norms allow for or preclude based on what they're hearing from Trump.
You know, it's interesting. When I was reading your study, I started to think about this recent brouhaha over Kevin Williamson being fired from The Atlantic for suggesting that women who have an abortion should be killed, things like that. It seems to me that we do have a duty to kind of defend pluralism. It's under challenge at this point, and there is a real reason that you say, okay, let us maintain certain norms of basic discourse that are acceptable, and say this other kind of brand of rhetoric shouldn't be acceptable and shouldn't be featured in our mainstream discourse. Now, conservative dog whistle politics isn't new. You can go back to the Nixon strategy. You could talk about Reagan demonizing welfare queens. You can look at basically whatever has come out of the mouths of immigration restrictionists for the past 20 or 30 years, maybe longer. Does the difference come down to Trump kind of eschewing the dog whistles for like air raid sirens? I mean, this guy is completely unsubtle. Is it that he has a tendency to say the quiet parts out loud?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically the point, is that, you know, in the past, norms were such that, you know, politicians at least had to hide their prejudice.
Yes.
And now, you know, Trump is basically getting away with not hiding it at all. And what's worrisome is that means that people feel like they don't have to hide their prejudice now. And then that's what I worry about, just as someone who sort of is, you know, would like to see the world, you know, be a friendlier and more functioning democracy, is that, you know, like, this is going to be a vicious cycle that, okay, you know, now people are hearing from Trump that it's okay to express more prejudice. And that means Trump will feel even other politicians will feel more emboldened to say more prejudicial things. And it's just going to sort of unravel. I think, you know, in the past, I think one of the things we relied on was elites sort of policing themselves about what was okay to say or not. And, you know, it's definitely the case that there were a lot of Republicans who, when Trump said the things about Mexicans or whatever, you know, said, oh, that's across the line, that's gone too far. But maybe there wasn't enough, and maybe it hasn't been, maybe those that kind of policing hasn't been consistent enough, you know, throughout Trump's campaign and now his presidency.
So we have empirical evidence that Trump has made America more hateful for communities of color, the foreign born. I should point out that there is, however, a small silver lining. There appears to be a reverse Trump effect as well. I've written about this a little bit at The Nation. The Pew has been asking people for over 20 years, do you think immigrants contribute to society? And I'm not quoting the question exactly, but in broad strokes, contribute positively to society or are in a burden to society? And since Trump came down that escalator, there's been a 27-point swing towards immigrants make are a positive contribution to society. Almost all of which came among Democrats and independents who lean towards Democrats. So while he emboldens his base, he also fires up the opposition. There have been similar findings about Americans' views of Islam as well. I guess it is a small silver lining, but it is something that we should acknowledge as well. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. This one dedicated to all ragamuffin, yeah, man. Yeah, man. Yamdown, Kingston, Portland, Westmoreland. Man, like all Papa Biggie, them man, who? A ram for them, man. I tell you, kawaii. Him raga raga, him raga muffin, Him raga raga, him raga muffin, Him raga raga, him raga muffin. Ragamuffin, Mr. Let the ragamuffin, the man. Yes, and Jitterbull Jesus to microphone stand. Muffin, Mr. Let the ragamuffin, the man. Yes, me come pitch up it from the disaversion because me raga raga, me raga muffin, Me raga raga, me raga muffin. Listen to me. Love you to talk about them ragamuffin, but me say, now I and I know we will clip them wing, and then me brethren through a shine, him do the killing, me teach a sassafras, him do the seasoning, the bastard the jack,
him do the frying. And Papa Biggie one just do the yamming, because him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. Him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. Come now, as your world stand attention. Now this one dedicated to all nyama man. As your world stand attention. Now this one dedicated to all nyama man. Say coolie man, no Chinese man, no and black man. Say white man, Jew man, and Syrian. Everybody gather up for the competition. International yamming contest of Portland. The white man say me a done. When me start, man, you just stand attention. Say what? The black man say me can yam. Look how me belly big like a wash pan. Say what? The coolie man say me can yam. Although me maga like any skillion. Last week I need 5 bag of yam. You should have bring 5 bag of rice in me possession. A bounce all that, bounce all a lamb, bounce all a sheep, bounce all a ram, bounce all the wife and now the husband. Cause this and yam a man down in a different fashion. Why? Because him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin, him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin, him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. Ragga muffin, I select the ragga muffin, the man. Yes, and this a Jim V at the microphone stand. Muffin, I select the ragga muffin, the man. Yes, me come pitch up it man and this a version. Me go, me ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. Oh, the bike, me ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. She the bike, ragga ragga, ragga muffin. No view to talk about them ragga muffin. About the culture different, they will clip them wing. And then now sugar shine on them when do the killing. Sasa first and then we do the seasoning. And that the jack one just do ninja mean. Because him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin, him ragga ragga, him ragga muffin. But buddy bye, has your word stand attention. Now this one dedicated to all nyama man. Has your word stand attention. Now this one dedicated to all nyama man. Like holy man, China man, and black man, white man, Jew man, and Syrian.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I am joined now by one of our favorite guests, Heather Digby Parton. Heather, of course, is a blogger at her own joint, Hullabaloo, and she writes a daily column. Daily column. Ugh, it's crazy for Salon. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Thanks for taking the time. So there was a report in NPR today about how Trump voters are feeling oppressed. They just don't understand why people are so mean to them. And I was looking at a poll that found that almost half of all Trump voters believe that white people are discriminated against in the United States. And they feel that white people are more discriminated against than other so-called minorities. And of course, this is a feature of evangelical Christianity. It is remarkable to me how deeply ingrained this victimhood complex has become.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's been there for a long time. I remember writing about this, you know, 15 years ago, about the victimization complex on the right. It's you know, it's a real rallying cry for them. I think you touched on maybe one of the reasons, which is the influence of the Christian right, and specifically evangelicalism. And that kind of conservative Christian sort of sense of oppression, you know, that's actually a long strain in Christianity, right? I mean, this is not something unusual and not even in, you know, ancient times, unreasonable, right? But I actually read a piece today, or not today, but, you know, a couple of days ago anyway, you know, on Fox News by this guy. He was a former Pentagon official and some other. He was in the Reagan and Bush senior White Houses doing something. So he was a Republican political guy, but also, you know, a Christian conservative, saying that it is 64 AD in the United States. It's Nero. I mean, that's what he said it in the piece, that we are at the place where in Rome. I mean, I haven't seen any Christians being fed to lions recently.
No lions.
But, you know, that is the level.
Was that the piece that was headlined something like, Christianity will soon be outlawed?
Yes. And And, you know, I mean, I'm reading this thing and I'm going, okay, you know, it seems to be that you know, that they're doubling down. It's not just that Christianity, you know, that Christianity isn't as popular as it used to be, or that we, you know, we heathens on the coasts are rude and dismissive of their beliefs now. Now, it's this literal sense that they're being oppressed. Now, you have to look at who they think they're being oppressed by, and some of that, of course, is, you know, this is just sheer Islamophobia, where they believe that Muslims are taking over the world and are literally killing Christians en masse, and that this is happening. You know, they see these stories from Europe, and I guess they probably think the same thing is happening here somewhere, and Sharia law is taking over, et cetera, et cetera. So that's part of it. But it's also, I just think that it's an organizing function of the right, is this victimization. It's always been this sense that they are this very, very oppressed minority, and that everyone else, the elites, the you know, people of color, that this group is arrayed against them, and that they are constantly under siege. And I think that really works as an organizing function for them. In fact, do you remember the guy Richard Viguerie? He was the person who basically invented political direct mail back in the 70s, and he's been a part of the old style Goldwater, you know, conservative movement. And then he's kind of, now he's a Trump guy. Of course, you know, he's a real opportunist. But he used to say, and he said it very, you know, without even the slightest bit of irony, that they always were better off when they were when they did not have political power, that the movement did better when they had, you know, when they could really gin up this sense of being oppressed and besieged. And he was very obvious about it. In fact, I remember reading a thing by him after the 2006 election that he was kind of relieved that they had been in power too long and that they needed to sort of regroup and rebuild their sense of victimization in order to, I assume, bring in the big bucks, which is a big part of what that guy did.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that there's even a certain awareness of this, that they have to keep this sense of, you know, and right now they have everything, right? They've got
yes.
The presidency, the court, the Supreme Court, they've got the Congress. I mean, they have their own television network. They've got it all.
Majority of state houses.
Yes. I mean, they couldn't be less oppressed, literally. And yet, you know, you see this. So, I mean, this is how they're organized around this. And it's very, very powerful. I think it's a very, very powerful thing for them. And let's just put it this way. I think it's worked for them really well. And weirdly enough, this freak show, Donald Trump, has managed to play right into that. Listen to him sometime. You want to talk about an aggrieved person. And everybody's unfair to him. Oh.
He's really capitalized on these long-term trends. Richard Viguerie is an interesting character, I think, because he's, as you say, he's kind of honest about this stuff. And for listeners who don't know, he's one of a small core of people who basically helped launch the modern conservative movement back in the late 50s, early 60s, when they were truly out in the wilderness. When Republicans were, you know, slightly less liberal than Democrats. And I interviewed him at one point, and he said, you know, we studied what worked for liberal politics, and we sought to emulate them. And I wonder, putting these two things together, you know, how much of this is a result of looking at the success of the civil rights movement and saying, wow, it's really powerful. It's really powerful to fight against an oppressor. That's a powerful message. And maybe we should be oppressed. Maybe we should be African Americans in Jim Crow, in the Jim Crow South. And they've basically, because they have their own media infrastructure, right? Because this is a constant, anybody who's been listening to Rush Limbaugh since the 80s knows that this is a constant. They're facing oppression at every, you know, from everywhere. And it's a cultural oppression. And that's probably where there's a kernel of truth, in that if you have a certain traditional, you know, right-wing mindset, your views are not well reflected in the popular culture. And there's many good reasons for that. But you know, I think that they really did use it, as you say, as an organizing principle. And Trump comes along, his entire message, if you think about it, was predicated on this idea. I mean, he said, you are being screwed over by stupid people who would prefer to, you know, give your job to an illegal, and Mexico is sending us their rapists, and China is, and he used the word again, China is raping us. He said this again and again. He really played into that victimhood narrative really effectively, and it was an overarching message in his campaign.
It certainly was, and I think you bring up an interesting point, because I am not sure. I think he did something that he took it to a different level than anybody had done before, with this notion that America, that the country, was being treated unfairly, and that same sense of victimization and besiegement was America in terms of its global position in the world. I don't recall conservatives, you know, framing it that way before. I mean, it was, they were besieged, but the country itself, America, was strong. We were a leader. We were in charge. We were the people who were making the rules. And Trump came along and kind of applied this sort of, you know, this victimization to the country as a whole, and created this idea that it's us against the world, everybody. I mean, there are no allies in Trump's eyes, right? I mean, none, not Canada. It's an enemy. I mean, and he created this sense that, you know, they're all treating us unfairly. We're being screwed. And it wasn't just on trade. It's all this stuff. Even this week, he was talking to Angela Merkel, and or with her, and, you know, going on and on about how America had been, you know, taken advantage of in trade deals with Europe, and that NATO was okay, but it was better for Europe rather than America. And, you know, and that's not a typical sort of isolationist viewpoint. I mean, he would wrap some of that in some of his rhetoric around what we traditionally think of as isolationism, which he says, you know, we'll bring the money home, and we'll put the money, you know, we'll spend the money here for our people, that kind of thing. But there was also this kind of deep-seated resentment of, you know, American, you know, leadership in the world being, quote, taken advantage of. He even said at some point that, you know, they're going to have to pay protection. Yeah, we've got this big military, which, by the way, he's, you know, building up beyond all recognition.
Yes.
And, you know, that they're going to have to, but they're going to have to pay if they want us to protect them, you know, our allies. This is, you know, this whole idea that they're not paying up. They're not giving us proper respect. I mean, that's a lot of it. It's just, we're not being respected. He's even said that explicitly. So I think he has taken this aggrievement mentality in a slightly new direction. And it's alarming, because what he's doing essentially is tearing up the global, you know, the sort of global security framework that's been in place for 70 years, without anything, obviously, in mind to replace it. So everything starts to look a little chaotic. People don't know what to think. The U.S. is unpredictable now, and we're very big and very, very, very dangerous if we're unpredictable. And so, you know, that it's having a you know, some consequences, this aggrievement attitude, that I think are maybe bigger than they've been before, and bigger than just our domestic grievances that we've been churning around, you know, since the 60s.
Yeah, and you know, the great irony in all of this, I should back up. He not only, you know, kind of tried to put the squeeze on NATO, but he also totally muddled how it works, and he said that they're not, you know, they're not paying their share, so we're paying more. Mm-hmm. Right? And the way NATO works is that there are targets for share of GDP on defense spending, but it's not mandatory. They're just targets. Anyway, the irony of all of this is that as he retreats from the world, others are moving to fill the gap, and we actually are losing influence and will be treated worse. China is investing all over Latin America. Mexico signed a free trade deal, I shouldn't say free trade, I'm sorry, a trade deal with the EU this week. So that is a great irony. Let's talk about some grifters capitalizing on this victimhood complex. Diamonds and silk.
My God.
Diamond and silk. How comical. How comical. First of all, did you know about these people? Like, when did these grifters come into your awareness?
It was sometime during the campaign. They somehow, and I couldn't tell you when or how they sort of bubbled up, but I think I saw YouTube that they did, and I thought, exactly what you're saying. I'm going, this is, smart move, ladies. Good work. How many, African American, right wing YouTube stars for Trump are there? This was a niche that was going unfilled, and
yeah,
they filled it. God
really
bless
is.
America, right? So I didn't really think anything, I just assume there's always that, especially around Trump, just the opportunities for the grift because he's their avatar, the grifter's avatar. Of course there was going to be some of that stuff, but I do find it amazing. And of course, it's interesting that this past week when Trump, he's on Fox and Friends, I think he called them warriors for Trump or something in the Fox and Friends interview. And they were before the one of the House subcommittees. I can't remember what, they were testifying almost at the same moment that he was saying this. And it was equally surreal as Trump's talk on Fox and Friends. They are amazing. I think they are really amazing. They have got a set of talking points that, they take victimhood to a totally new level. It's completely untethered to reality. They have been oppressed. Facebook has blocked them, and everybody's going, no, they haven't. that's not the case. You can still do what you want on Facebook. And they're, no, it's not true. I'm just telling you, it's not true. And they said it before a congressional committee, and everybody on the committee that are trying to interrogate them there, they're kind of just shaking their heads, looking around, going, "Well, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to deal with this."
But this committee hearing, this committee hearing is part of the answer to the question: how can people delude themselves when they are the majority? And I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about conservatives, most of whom are white.
Of course.
How can people delude themselves to believe that they are an oppressed minority when they're in charge of everything? And part of the answer to that is the conservative media complex, including now members of Congress. So this was a hearing, and I'm sure there are listeners who didn't pay attention to this. This was a hearing on these two YouTube stars supposedly being oppressed by Facebook. And what happened was Facebook changed its algorithm, and now all of our stuff is not featured as prominently. Left, right, center, doesn't matter. And for normal people, it's like, okay, Facebook changed its algorithm. That's bad for my, media enterprise. And on the right, it's help, I'm being oppressed. And that hearing was on a claim that has been widely debunked. Everybody knows it's just that Facebook changed its algorithm. And Ted Lieu, the congressman from California, Democrat, I think he put it best. His opening remarks, he said, "This hearing is stupid and ridiculous." This is a stupid and ridiculous hearing. which is first of all why I like Ted Lieu, one of the reasons.
Oh yeah, he's my congressman.
He's really good. He calls them as he sees them. And it was a stupid and ridiculous hearing, and they lied to Congress repeatedly during that hearing, claiming that they had not been paid by the Trump campaign during the 2016 election. FEC filings show the opposite is true. They got $1,300 for some field research or something like that. And it's funny because the, you know, it's illegal to lie to Congress and to do so repeatedly. And yet, if they were to be punished for that, it would make their entire career. They'd be in like Flynn. It would be a permanent, you know, a permanent perch on the conservative speaker's circuit and a higher profile in conservative media. It's just such a grift. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Heather Digby Parton, one of our favorite guests, about the conservative persecution complex. Another grifter, Kevin Williamson.
Oh, boy.
And this one's amazing because there's two points that I think stand out for Kevin Williamson. First of all, he is a guy who preaches personal responsibility to genuinely marginalized groups. So, you know, if you're black or gay or poor, then that is your fault entirely. There's no such thing as structural racism. There's no such thing as structural discrimination of any kind, except for Kevin Williamson, because when he engages in gratuitously offensive rhetoric that is, again, gratuitous, unnecessary for the arguments he's making, and that makes him a poor fit for an outfit like The Atlantic, which fired him after people dug out comments about thinking women should be hanged for abortion. He blames everybody but himself for that.
Well, I mean, I think that's how this works, doesn't it? I mean, this sense of victimization. I mean, look at Donald Trump, but he's a perfect example. I mean, nothing is ever his fault. Everything is blamed on someone else. He either takes credit or blames. There's no in between. There's nothing beyond that. And I think Kevin Williamson is that kind of guy. I mean, he's a very interesting case because maybe you can help me out here. I don't understand what it is that everybody seems to think is so great about
big
him.
Big words. It's that. That's it.
I guess. I
Big
mean,
words.
His
There's
writing
nothing
seems
interesting
kind
about
of
his writing.
To me, I don't really find it very insightful, and I frankly don't find it particularly believable. I mean, the reporting that he does just seems completely. I mean, I just don't think people talk the way that he says they do.
And here's a good rule of thumb: if anybody ever describes a black person under 60 years old calling them a cracker, they made that up.
I agree with you.
Right.
That just does not ring true. It doesn't happen. It's not. It's like almost like saying honky or something. You know,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, like if you yes, honky is another one. If you are describing an African American calling you a honky or a cracker in service of writing a piece about how you are being oppressed by black people, you are making those quotes up almost certainly.
At the very least, some editor somewhere should require you to go get that person, bring them back to the office, and force them to admit that they used that word, because otherwise it is simply not believable. And I think a lot of Williamson's work, it appeals to this, there's a certain crowd, you know, and, you know, I mean, maybe this is irrelevant, but I'm just going to throw it out here anyway. There's another person who went around making, you know, big moral judgments against marginalized people. His name was Bill Cosby. I mean, that was one of his big things, too. You know,
yes.
There's a certain kind of sort of a macho guy. And, you know, in this case, of course, Williamson, he's, you know, filled with all kinds of racist animosity. And I don't think that's true of Cosby, although one could certainly look at it that way. You know, the fact is he's black, but he was very, very successful. And also, as it turns out, a felonious criminal rapist. But, it kind of reminds me of that. This Kevin Williamson and Bill Cosby, there's a certain type of guy who goes around, you know, basically, you know, with a kind of a superiority complex, telling all the bad people among their tribe that, you know, they need, that they're doing it wrong. And Williamson likes to, you know, pretend like he's going to take on the irresponsible white people as well as the irresponsible blacks. He makes a big, you know, play on that. There are others who are doing that too. You know, this it's sort of a new sort of subgenre of writing of, you know, white people who are, what's the guy's name? I've forgotten it. Who wrote the book, Hillbilly Elegy?
Yeah, Vance.
Yeah. You know, what is it? Vance, I'm getting old.
Hillbilly Elegy. Elegy, yes.
Elegy, you know. I mean, you know that there's this genre of people who are, you know, sort of being disdainful of those who aren't pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And, you know, Cosby was one of those guys.
I mean,
and Williamson...
Murray did that, right?
Yeah,
First he did the bell curve, and then he was like, okay, well, maybe I should go after these poor white communities, too.
Right. And, you know, these people, you know, taking on the opioid crisis and talking about how, you know, these people are degenerate and have no morals and they just need to, you know, get with the program. And I maybe that genre's always been around and I'm just noticing it in this particular era. But, you know, Williamson is one of those guys. And of course, but he took it to an entirely different level of malevolence. When they turned up this stuff about how he thinks, you know, he was sort of saying, and I guess he's trying to argue that he was just, you know, kind of taking the argument to its logical conclusion, which, you know, he was, which
yes.
is that if abortion is murder, that all these women who've had abortions should be executed, you know,
now
they
he's
should
not,
be given
he's not
capital
for the death
punishment.
Penalty, so, of course, maybe... But here's the thing with that.
Maybe just life in prison. How about
He's such a dishonest writer. He likes to portray himself as a brave, courageous truth teller who won't bow to the, you know, social justice warriors with their PC culture, right? He's speaking truth to power. And yet, he refuses to say what he thinks should be the punishment for women who get an abortion. And it's almost comical how he's done this, right? Let's review. Ed Kilgore at New York Magazine said, okay, I'm gonna ask him. And he had an email correspondence with Kevin Williamson, who refused to answer or engage. Then Williamson took to the pages of the Weekly Standard. It's J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance wrote him.
J.D. Vance, right. Yeah.
So he, and it, that's always the way it works with me, like when I'm trying to remember something. If I just talk about something
no,
else,
too.
It'll pop into my head. So... He goes to the pages of the Weekly Standard to write a complaint about Ed Kilgore asking about this. And he calls Ed Kilgore a partisan hack. Ed Kilgore is not very partisan, by the way.
No.
And nor is he a hack. He's been on the show many times. And then he got a column in the Washington Post. And that column is titled, Kevin Williamson... What I think the punishment should be for women who have an abortion. And he wrote that entire column, and nowhere in that column with that title does he say what Kevin Williamson thinks should be the punishment for women with abortion, who get an abortion. It is remarkable. And this is not good writing, and this is not honest writing, and this is not brave writing. He does not want to take that to its logical conclusion. Because he knows that it is not a place where he's going to end up in a good spot.
Oh, it absolutely isn't. Although, you know, you bring up an interesting point. I mean, this truth-telling thing, you know, I'm the iconoclast who's going to come out and say it. You people are all too chicken to actually say what's really going on and, you know, what you're really thinking. And, you know, this past week there was another thing that sort of happened along that line, which was that Kanye West came out as a big fan of Donald Trump. And he had said that before. I mean, this wasn't anything new. He had said it after the election. He went to Trump Tower. And, you know, you can kind of see why he thinks he's, you know, why he would be a fan of Trump, at least on the sort of showbiz performance art level. And there is some speculation that Kanye is doing this because he has an album that's about to drop and that this is his way of ginning up publicity for it. I have no idea. I know he did wind up in a psychiatric ward last year at some point after having gone a little over the edge. So who knows where this is heading. But regardless of all that, what's interesting about it is the way it's been being received by right-wing media. I mean, Sean Hannity did a whole thing. This is a sea change in American culture. You know, this apparently this now means that African Americans are flowing to Donald Trump because they love him so much. And Laura Ingraham, who wrote a book called Shut Up and Sing, complaining about celebrities saying that having political opinions, and just recently getting into a huge row with LeBron James and telling him to shut up and dribble, right? I mean, she made part of her career on this idea that celebrities shouldn't say anything. She's out there now on her program this week extolling the virtues of Kanye West and how terrific it is that he's, you know, bringing this idea. And the reason that they're all giving is because Kanye, like Kevin Williamson, is, you know, he isn't towing the party line. He's out there telling the truth, willing to go up against the oppressive political correctness that's forcing everybody to think the same way. They're all so brave, right? They're all so brave, including Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Donald Trump. They're all saying things that nobody else will say because, you know, they're brave and they're going up against it. Again, oppressed people, they're heroes, they're warriors. Diamond and Silk are warriors. You know, I mean, this is all part of their shtick, their game, their grift, whatever it is. And they're, you know, so they get to they're doing this kind of morality play, this big, you know, we have to be brave and stand up to the powers that are trying to take us down.
I mean, with the thing with Laura Ingraham is it just shows that they're utterly shameless and they have a remarkable capacity to avoid cognitive dissonance. But I just want to get back to Kevin Williamson for one more quick point, which is that, and I should say, I do believe that The Atlantic served him poorly because he was a known quantity. They hired him and fired him. And if you're going to hire a intentionally provocative, gratuitously obnoxious right-wing bomb thrower, I mean, why fire him for being an intentionally provocative, gratuitous, you know? But another point here that I think is relevant is that there is a structural problem for writers of his ilk, which is that you come up through the conservative media and there are very powerful incentives to own the libs, to be that brave truth teller who won't bow down to political correctness. So, you know, they are egged on and encouraged to be, offensive and melt those liberal snowflakes. And then somebody at The Atlantic wants to hire them. And look, they have this history, this written track record of being super obnoxious and over the top. And, you know, the reality is that conservative voices are extremely well represented in in mainstream media. There are 18 conservatives regularly featured on the opinion pages of just three outlets, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, according to a piece in Slate this week. And it's you can't be a belligerent, over-the-top, you know, hateful conservative, but you know what? You can't be a belligerent, over-the-top leftist either.
Oh, and where are they? I mean, are there any belligerent, over-the-top leftists in mainstream media?
No.
I mean, they exist in this world. I know
they
them.
Absolutely do.
I don't see them represented at all. I mean, the most belligerent people are, you know, people like you and me.
Yeah.
we're not the most belligerent leftist people in the political spectrum by any means. And I don't think either one of us are akin to Kevin Williamson. I mean,
but
I don't think
Jeffrey Goldberg would give us a job in the first place.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Right? I mean,
not.
Because we don't have that. There's no affirmative action program for people, for writers on the left. But apparently there is one for writers on the right. Heather Digby Parton, I believe we are out of time. It is always such a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
My pleasure, Joshua. It was fun. Thanks for having me.
I also want to thank Brian Schaffner. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Howell. Follow my writings at The Nation. Check out my weekly column at Raw Story called What Fresh Hell. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at iPod or at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'd also like to thank the folks at Crooks and Liars and Digby again at Hullabaloo and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you excellent people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.